Chair, we'll do a brief round of introductions. Again, this is a challenge to bring the task force together at the tail end of our waning summer. So I appreciate all those that have been able to carve the time out and attend. So in the room, we'll go around and introduce ourselves for recording purposes, as well as to make sure that those on the phone are aware of who's in the room. So start to my left.
Oh, Sandy, staff.
Lori Monis Anderson, state senator.
Coralie Koning, president, Oregon Society of Physician Assistants.
Ruth Bauman, A True Health Plan.
Again, we have a number of guests in the room as well. And those on the phone, if you could introduce yourselves, please.
Robin Henderson, state
senator. Okay. Very good. Welcome. So as we go forward, if additional members come into attendance, then we'll make sure we note that as well. Today is an informational meeting. The meeting's intended to walk through the revised report. That will be following a discussion. We've been fortunate enough to have two of the leaders within the Department of Consumer and Business Services come and join us and talk about the insurance division. And that's, again, been a question that the task force has brought to the table, and they've been kind enough to join us. So we'll introduce them in a moment. Just joining us, Dr. Gluckman.
Hi, Bob Gluckman.
Good to have you, sir.
Thanks.
Robin and Senator Canopa on the phone. Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
And our latest arrival. Good morning. We have Representative Parrish with us. And as they trickle in, we also have the legendary Dr. Janine Smith. Welcome. I think we're on Oregon casual time, so it's
Senate time is what we usually
is that what you guys call it?
I heard there was a lot of traffic out there.
Yeah.
That's actually a lie.
Is it really? Okay.
I don't have that excuse.
Okay. I'll try to help you out here.
out searching for quarters. Again, I welcome everybody to this meeting. And as I said before, we're fortunate enough to have with us today Jeanette Holman, one of the senior policy analysts, as well as Cliff Nolan, who is the chief market analyst for the insurance division. And the reason for their attendance today is the task force had brought up concerns around how is it that we can assure ourselves that, in fact, the statute changes in that were brought about with House Bill 2902, in fact, are occurring. These fine folks are those that actually make sure that the insurers of the state are following the directives of the statute. So we've asked them to come and explain a little bit about the division, about their work, and to try to help better understand how they actually monitor those things. And then at the completion of their time, what we're going to ask is, what would you as a group want to make sure that they are monitoring over the course of at least the next year and perhaps beyond around the compliance? And what are the specific questions that we would want to make sure are addressed over time? And hopefully that will give them clarity around how they provide the analytic support for that compliance function. Okay, so if perhaps we could ask our guests to join us.
Where?
Yeah. And I've done probably a shoddy job in introducing you as well as describing your role. So as you introduce yourselves, if you could describe your role and background and how you how you sort of intersect with this work, that would be fabulous.
Terrific.
So, I don't know if you were going to start or Cliff.
I think I got to start. Chair Kincaid, members of the task force, for the record, I am Jeanette Holman. Senior,
can you guys on the phone hear her okay?
You can't hear
her. You can't hear?
Very well.
It's kind of hard. She's really quiet.
Okay, well, we'll put the microphone closer, and then I'll move the speaker a little bit.
Well, we're going to ask her to use her loud voice,
right,
which is
my
the,
outside
the opposite
voice
of what we always told our children. But we will try to see if we can get as much projection there as possible.
Do you want us to go
over
there?
And if not, what we may do is actually bring you guys over.
Yeah, why don't we just move?
Why don't we bring you to those two seats right there?
I guess moving people is easier. Than
yeah, look over there.
We're just going to do a little, we're doing a little musical chairs here, so hopefully that will help from a sound standpoint. So if those on the phone, if you can't hear Jeanette and Cliff, then please let us know.
Okay, let's start over again. Chair Kincaid and members of the task force, for the record, I am Jeanette Holman, the senior policy analyst and legislative liaison for the Insurance Division of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. With me today is Cliff Nolan, who is our chief market analyst for the Insurance Division. And we've been here asked to talk about a couple of things today. One, of course, is how DCBS enforces the requirements of House Bill 2902, that the requirements to provide an equity and pay for mental health services provided and primary services provided by a physician assistant or a certified nurse practitioner at the same level as a licensed physician if the service is within their scope of practice. And second, we've been asked to talk about the kinds of consumer complaints, if any, that we've received to date, and possible ways to collect data that would be useful to this task force in completing your assignments. I'm going to have Cliff really go more into the DCBS enforcement, but briefly, some of the things that we have done to date are we've done some outreach with the nurses. Particularly, we've done a joint webinar that I believe is still on their website. We've encouraged folks to call our consumer advocates if there's a complaint. And then Cliff has done some work with market surveillance. In the course of doing this, there's a couple of areas that I think this task force might want to look at. The area of practice, and this is not defined in the bill, but the limitations or the restrictions or the directions to the insurers about what it means to pay the same thing within the that's paid in other areas of the, it's a geographic area of practice, not a area of treatment. So what does that mean? Does that mean the area of the state? Does it mean Multnomah County? Does it mean, you know, eastern, western Oregon? It's not clear. That is actually something we could define by rule if we wanted to, if we felt there was a need to do that. The other area,
need legislation for that?
I think that we could do that under our rulemaking authority because it would be deemed clarifying
we
the
We can't
terms.
Direct you to do that. It is already in your purview.
Yeah, as our general rulemaking authority to clarify the terms of legislation.
Do we have evidence that there are major differences in rates across the country, across the state? You know, one of the things is that when you're talking about an equivalent rate, many health plans will have a standard contract, and then there are some entities that have more market power and then can have leverage. I really feel like this applies to the standard rate. You know, if they're part of an entity that has that leverage, they would get paid the same because they'd be covered under the contract.
Right.
But I, otherwise, I think this would be extremely difficult to administer.
We know.
And if you're talking about equivalence based on licensure, it should actually be that these are there are folks with MD and DO degrees that are being paid the same as the contracts that are offered to nurse practitioners and this is, you know, nurse practitioner legislation. So I think that would be in compliance.
I think it probably would.
I think you're right if your question is that there are no contracts with an insurer in a county at the same rate that you're providing offering a nurse practitioner, that would not be in compliance.
Right. And I think the rates are different in Pendleton than they are in Portland. And Cliff might know a little bit more about this than I do, but
I would say not a whole lot more, but that is also the sense that I've gotten, is that you're going to have some variations. And for the record, I should say I'm Cliff Nolan, Chief Market Analyst of the Oregon Insurance Division. So
are you saying you think that insurance companies pay a different reimbursement rate for, say, physicians in different parts of the state?
That is my sense of it.
Yeah. Well, there would be some reasons for that. So, you know, first of all, practice expenses differ, cost of living differs, supply differs, and so, you know, those things are, and then there are some areas where there are shortages, and that actually can drive rates up. That isn't necessarily to be unexpected. You know, just as there are many other professions in the state where people aren't paid the same everywhere in the state.
Well, interestingly, then, that they don't change their rates for small group or individual by different parts of the state.
Well, there may be. Is that the carrier's issue, or is that the state regulatory
I'm just
environment?
That's what the state does. I'm saying that's what the insurers do. I've done it for 35 years, so I know pretty much what most of them do inside their reimbursement formula. So I'm just saying they don't vary their rates to the consumers that way.
Yeah, well, I think it's because the pool is statewide.
No, it's not.
No. For the individual product? We have one rate.
Yeah, I know you have one rate. That's not the way the rates have to be set. They're set by I think it's, what, 5 or 6 regions in the state?
Mm-hmm.
So that's exactly the point I made, one statewide rate.
For individual.
Right.
Yeah, and there might not be large enough pools to actually have reliable, because you have to have a large enough pool. That's an interesting question. I could certainly bring that back to our underwriting people, because it's not an area where I have content expertise. But I think there are probably some rational reasons about how you need a large enough pool to be able to do some of that. So
I'm sure there are reasons. Yeah.
Well, we've just gone through our rate review process for 2015 rates, and I believe that Laura will be appearing to talk to a couple of legislative committees about rate review and the results of that in September. The other issue that has come up, and we've actually received complaints about, is the definition of independent practice, and we can't fix this one. The bill defines independent practice as the physician's ties it to the physician's assistant or nurse practitioner's own name and own national provider identifier. And the problem has come in where there's a clinic that is organized with a number of independent nurses or physician's assistants working together in that clinic, and the billing goes out in the clinic's name, and that carriers are saying no, we have to pay it only if it's the individual who is billing it under their individual name. And this came up in, I think, kind of at a late point during the session. They discussed this a little bit, but we looked at it to see if there was some way we could make that broader, and I don't think we can do it without legislation. So that's one area. Consumer complaints, like most of our enforcement mechanisms now, our enforcement is driven by consumer complaints. And a consumer includes providers. Providers can also file a consumer complaint with us. And that process is, our consumer advocates try to resolve the problem. They work with the insurer, they work with the consumer. And if they can't, or if they see a number of problems coming in, then it gets kicked over to our market surveillance folks. So far, we have only received 3 complaints under this bill.
Over what period of time?
Since the bill took effect. Mm-hmm. And one of those was a provider complaint. I'm not sure if they all were. Our consumer advocacy manager has been out of the office, so I haven't been able to get all of the details. And we have not been, which surprises me, tracking these separately. So my suggestion to them was that they need to start tracking these complaints separately so we have a better idea of what we're getting. But we think there's only been 3, but we need to confirm that.
And the complaint focus primarily on reimbursement?
One of them at least did. I think there were a couple. And
I honestly have only seen one of those complaints. And again, this is Cliff Nolan, Chief Market Analyst of the Insurance Division. I've only seen one of those complaints, and that was a file that was sent over from the Consumer Advocacy Unit for our unit to review. Reimbursement was the issue in that case. And the issue of the individual practice as opposed to clinic practice was also the focus of that particular issue as well. So
there's a couple of other issues that we've been asked about. An HMO, like a Kaiser plan, are specifically exempt from this plan because they already have their own providers within the system. And the other issue, and I believe we actually got a question in our consumer complaints section about this, government plans like PEB are not included because they do not have to comply with the insurance code. Now, often they have provisions in their contract with the whoever's administering the plan for them that says they'll comply with particular provisions of the insurance code. But we don't have any regulatory authority over them.
So, who's that? I'm sorry.
The Public Employees Benefit Board.
So I can tell you that on the physical health side, I know with certainty that we pay the same because we did prior to the legislation. I believe we are in mental health, but I'd have to confirm, you know, with Optum because I don't know that with certainty, but I believe we are paying the same. And I can bring that back to the committee.
Does that include OEB too?
OEB is a little different because OEB has a provider. They have a fully funded plan, which means that they just purchase it on the commercial market. And then, of course, they have Kaiser, which isn't covered, but they have the other Moda plan that they have is purchased on the market, so they are subject to this.
Okay.
So I'm going to turn over to Cliff now, and he's going to tell you a little bit more about the market surveillance process and walk you through how we do data calls, which is our mechanism for getting really specific information from the carriers.
Okay.
Now, do we have a copy?
You know, I just made these up yesterday,
but
I tell you what, I would be glad to send a copy to Sandy for the record.
Yeah, sure, we'll send our little hockey notes over.
That's okay.
Okay, all right. Mr. Chairman and members of the task force, again, I'm Cliff Nolan, Chief Market Analyst with the Oregon Insurance Division. And as Jeanette has indicated, I'll talk to you just a little bit about our process in the Market Surveillance Unit. I do work in the Market Surveillance Unit of the Insurance Division. My title is Chief Market Analyst. And we really take on several different functions. We really do a lot of company investigations. We do data calls. We do other projects, sometimes surveys of the industry. So we take on a number of different functions. We get involved in a number of policy issues as well, and assist the policy analysts like Jeanette at the insurance division. In terms of the process for that we use on market surveillance cases, a lot of them start out as consumer complaints. So the consumer advocacy section will take a complaint against a particular insurance company. That can come from either a consumer or a provider. And if they find any violations or even just have concern about a particular business practice by the insurer, those cases then get referred on to our unit, and we dig deeper into those. And provider complaints with a large number of claims at this point are also being sent over to the market surveillance unit as well. And what we do, we basically we just review and investigate these cases for specific practices or patterns of conduct that might be having an impact on other consumers. So we don't just focus on one consumer. We focus on company practices and try and get things cleaned up as a whole with insurers. We use various tools to do this, including written questions for insurers, data calls. We'll meet with company representatives as needed. And really, we look to make sure that all the violations, if violations are occurring, that those are all found, that improper business practices are corrected, and that consumers are made whole. In other words, there's a real focus there on corrective action, getting problems corrected with insurers, and our investigations can result in enforcement actions and sanctions against insurers. That's kind of the ultimate result when we find violations. So that, in a nutshell, is really the way it works. A lot of our cases come from consumer advocacy. Not all of them do. We might get cases referred or things reported from various entities, sometimes inside the insurance division. Sometimes a legislator might contact us with a particular concern. So we get them from various sources, but our goal is to try and kind of dig into these cases and try and get things cleaned up with the insurers as much as possible. So any questions about that before I talk about data calls?
Just one question, Cliff, on the, if you established that there was a problem, mm-hmm. a violation of conduct, and then you establish a corrective action plan, do you then have some sort of audit mechanism, or how do you assure action is?
Yes, definitely. There are cases that we will go back in and follow up with the insurer to make sure that things are being cleaned up the way that that we would propose. So yeah, we do follow up with insurers in some of these cases.
But it is all consumer or provider complaint driven. It's not active surveillance or
it can be active surveillance as well. I mean, there's cases, we may not have many consumer complaints on any, say a case like this with House Bill 2902. Fairly new legislation. We haven't had much activity on this yet, and we haven't done a lot at this point. But regardless of whether there's consumer complaints or not, if needed, we can, do a data call and review how companies are carrying out the mandate under House Bill 2902 or a similar piece of legislation as well. So, well, I guess I'll go ahead and talk to you for just a minute about data calls. In terms of our regular practice on data calls, a lot of times we really will just start out with surveys of industry, requests for their policies and procedures, and try and review compliance in that way. If there appears to be more of a problem or if we have a concern of some kind, we can do a full-fledged data call of insurers. Undertake that. We can get whatever information we need from insurers, to monitor and determine compliance. For our review purposes, in regard to this particular bill, I kind of had three thoughts in terms of elements that we would probably need to look at or would be needed to look at in regard to this bill. One piece of information that would be really important to get would be provider identifier numbers. And the reason why that's important is because really that is what you would use with industry to determine who the physicians are, who the physician's assistants are, who the nurse practitioners are. Those numbers are not assigned in a specific way because of that classification. So you'd almost have to find out, probably from the state medical board. I think they may have this information. Not sure about that, but I'm understanding that they might. But you'd almost have to get some kind of a listing of those numbers so that you could then sample based upon those numbers in particular for different classifications like physicians or nurse practitioners or so on.
Doesn't the MPI number already do that?
Based on some conversations I had, I'm not sure that it does.
So what are you trying to achieve with the number? What are you trying to get at?
We would try to figure out who the physicians are, how we could decode the information that insurers provide us so that we could know who the physicians are, who the physician's assistants are, and who the nurse practitioners are.
I don't know that the MPI number has the credentials.
Yeah.
I think that's your question, right?
And that's her question. That's kind of what I was addressing.
Well, most insurance companies' provider number doesn't have any intelligence in it in terms of what kind of provider it is.
Exactly,
and
right.
Providers have many ID numbers with the same carrier because they have different contracts. They work in different lives, and that's going to be a bowl of spaghetti trying to figure out.
And I think you might be very well correct about that. And that's just an issue we might have to work through if a data call is needed in relation to this particular bill. But that's not uncommon. There's always issues that you have to work through in regard to getting data and reviewing data from insurers. The other pieces of information that would be important, I think, number one would be CPT codes, just in terms of determining specific services that you're wanting to review in terms of reimbursements to providers. And the other thing that would be important would probably be zip codes, because location, as we've already discussed here, is a factor in regard to the reimbursements on these services. So you'd probably need that as well. One thing I wanted to mention is that a data call can also be completed under the insurance division's authority if the task force wished to try and review or aggregate data or have another agency do so. If you wanted to get OHA involved or another agency, we could obtain data and turn that over as needed. So
the analytics division of the health authority works very closely with the insurance division on several projects and have over the years. So
really that's
these four things then: the provider identifier number, the CPT codes, the zip code, and having another agency. You couldn't do any of that by rule then.
We don't need a rule. We already have the authority to do it.
We
just need to know what people want us to find out.
Yeah.
We need questions from us.
Yeah. And Senator, this is just initial thoughts in regard to how something like this might work. And I literally did a couple of phone calls on this just yesterday, and in the course of putting this together, just my own thoughts and trying to get a sense from an industry representative in particular, just in terms of how something like this might work. So it'd be a work in progress, like everything else.
Yeah. There's one other potential source of information that is going on that I want to mention. As many of you know, the ACA requires insurers to have an adequate network. And the division is putting together legislation for next session to address this issue. And so we're looking at network adequacy as a whole, but also one of the things that we anticipate finding out is where the shortages are. And there's a particular program that we're looking at, and it's pretty expensive, and OHA may already have it, we're not sure. The Quest program, have you heard of it?
I'm not sure.
They track, using the information that they gather, you can tell areas of the state that have a shortage of supplies, of a particular type of provider, you can look at whether there's no providers, and it helps kind of focus where you want to spend your efforts.
Is this for large group and small group?
It's focused on the provider, so it doesn't really matter. And I'm not sure how they do it, but the program is fairly expensive. So what we're exploring at this point is whether we could partner with OHA or another agency, or whether we could do it as a pilot project to see whether we gather information that would be useful. So we're just starting to look at that as a potential piece of that network adequacy program that we're going to have to run.
Will you under standards?
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask.
That are set by, we're set within the ACA that would define adequacy?
They are loose, and that's part of what we are doing is looking at whether there's a right now the proposed legislation has two options for us to determine or for an insurer to show that they have an adequate network. One is by being certified by a national program, a nationally recognized program. Medicaid already has some network adequacy requirements, but they don't transfer completely to the commercial market, so we would have to tweak some of those. The other thing is that the interim work group on this is putting together a list of a number of factors that we would look at to determine whether the network was adequate or not.
So Medicare requires any contractor to provide data in a very specific way to show network adequacy.
I believe so.
And,
yeah.
And so carriers buy that software themselves to do that report. So you might want to think about whether you need to buy the software to do it, or you need to get the carriers who you're regulating to provide you that information.
Yeah. And we, the Medicare stuff is, like I said, not quite the same kind of information that the carriers are going to have to provide.
How's it
as
different?
I don't know the details.
So what, I mean, my understanding of what Medicare, I don't know what Medicaid requires, but Medicare requires that you show that you have X percentage, and you can vary the percentage of primary care physicians within so many miles of an individual, which is kind of the national standard. You know, you can vary that number you want it to be at, but that's kind of the way that people look at it. Is that how you're trying to look at it?
Well, that's one of the factors, the time and distance factor. Mm-hmm. But there are others. I should have brought it with me.
I sit on that committee, and there's sort of the traditional way, and then there's the think outside the box, because with telemedicine and other things, do those make sense? So could a carrier offer that we can still meet that standard, but we're doing it in a non-traditional way? So we're trying, the committee's sort of trying to come up with, you either go the traditional way or else demonstrate to the division that you're meeting it in a different way. And we're trying to sort of refine how that would be and whether that's,
But in terms of spending money on software.
Right. And
I think you can probably accommodate what you're trying to get
right.
at and, with the basic
and,
software.
And then in addition, there is the workforce database that we have that's based on licensing already. Mm-hmm. And so that data could be cut differently to be
It sounds like from what you said that if someone was meeting the Medicare criteria across the state, it would meet the state's criteria. You're going to allow for some
more innovative definitions of network adequacy that they
right. So that's what I was going to say is if someone had an exception to the Medicare policy, you may honor it because they're able to provide their services in some innovative way.
And they'd have to demonstrate that to the division.
Right.
And to your point, they may not have to buy the software themselves to confirm
right.
it or not.
Yeah, which was my only point. Is it? Does the state really want to buy more software and then try to pull everybody's data into it?
Yeah.
Is probably not a good way to go.
No, we have lots of those.
Plenty
already.
Of those to deal with.
Is there a defined set of providers that you are looking at the level of those services? In other words, or is it limited to I mean, our work has sort of been focused on the physician and PA. does it look at other types of providers within the system, and how is that scope determined?
It looks at both the primary care, the mental health would definitely be, and it would be all kinds, naturopaths, acupuncture, all spectrums, because the idea is that adequate network should provide some choice to their consumers about the kinds of care that they want to get, or the kinds of providers they want access to.
There some standard percentage that was problem, how many chiropractors you need for a given geography, right, and a given distance.
So you're going to get that specific?
Well, not in the bill.
Well, they would set something as a standard, so possibly the Medicare standard would be the traditional version, and then there'd be parameters around how you could be innovative. But we wouldn't be, I mean, we would pick a sort of standard that everybody's already sort of meeting, like Medicare, Medicare Advantage, something like that.
So you're kind of saying like a baseline.
So there's a base, you either do it the traditional way,
right,
and here's what our standard that we're going to agree upon to be used as the standard, not create a new standard. And then here's the parameters in which you can work outside that standard, and here's what the division is going to look at when you try to propose to do that.
So are there national quality standards?
There's the Medicare.
That's
where there's a couple of standards that have been tossed around
NCQA.
NCQA, but I don't think that's quite complete enough, and so they're trying to, and what they may end up doing is saying that the division will pick a national standard, and they can also approach it so that we have some flexibility if one of these standards that are just now emerging becomes something that we want to say, okay, if you meet this, you comply. So it's not set in stone in the statute.
So just so you understand, on the Medicare side, because it's done nationally for, every kind of area in the country, where it has a lot of difficulty with is in rural areas and looking at geographic barriers. So, every year we frequently go through a conversation that we have a big mountain chain that goes through the middle of Oregon, and you can't just hop on either side of it in the wintertime. And that's why, you don't always have the same number of providers available in certain areas of the state. So they don't get, there's rivers and mountains and things like that in the way. But other than that, it's pretty standard.
Is there a time frame in which this needs to be enacted?
Well, we're bringing it to the 2015 legislature. I think the operative date is intended to be January 1st, 2017.
It brings Oregon up to the ACA standards.
Up to the ACA standard by January 17.
Mm-hmm.
At least that's what you believe.
So that's the ACA timeline. They've given us that much time.
Yeah.
Okay.
And that's for all payers that contract within the state.
All the regulated plans.
Right? All regulated plans.
So will you require? I'm still confused on the naturopath, chiropractor. I mean, they're very interested in they want their names in there, that every plan needs to have chiropractors and naturopaths as
they're
part of the system. Will it be worded that this will be a mandate? Or to me, network adequacy is a little bit, doesn't get specific.
And that's where the factor-based approach will give companies an opportunity to include those different kinds of practices. And we do have a provision in the ACA that says carriers cannot discriminate against a particular kind of practitioner. So we feel like, we have to open it up to different kinds of practitioners, different licensed practitioners, and leave it more to the carriers to make sure that they're not discriminating within their network against any particular kind.
There's a chiropractor and a naturopath on the committee.
Yeah. and they're very vocal.
Yes.
I've already started hearing about network adequacy already, so.
But to the senator's point, is it that you're looking for adequacy, or are you looking also for disclosure? Because there, you know, there is a concept of narrow networks that has a point and a purpose, but the problem is when consumers don't understand what that network is. So I thought some of this was geared at really better transparency.
It is. There's the other piece of the whole network adequacy bill is information to the consumers about what providers are actually in the network and which providers are actually really taking new patients. Because that's been a problem that we've run into, is that carriers may have a beautiful looking network, but none of their providers are taking new patients.
You also want to ensure that there isn't a bait and switch, because I think that was the problem on the East Coast, is they published a network and then they term people.
Yeah.
And, so you term people that you think you're getting when you purchase the product, and that is, you know, below the bar.
So we're looking at some disclosures that the carriers are going to have to make to their prospective insureds, as well as some to tell them, you know, these people also have a responsibility to make sure that the provider that they really want is really in that network and taking patients. And some information about how do I do this? So guiding those people through that process of checking on providers and making sure that, you know, their provider is in that network. And there's so many plans, and some providers are in the network for one plan with a particular insurer, but not in others. So that adds to the confusion. So we're trying to get at something that'll address all those issues.
And your charge is to bring that to the 2015 legislature as a report of progress,
It's a proposed legislation.
Proposed legislation.
It'll be a bill.
It adjusts the Oregon statutes to then be in compliance with ASA.
And in fact, when I send this stuff to Sandy, I think that we have a draft that we're sending out for public comment.
An LC draft?
An unofficial LC draft.
Right.
That I can send to Sandy that you can take a look at if you want.
Yeah, there's a placeholder in, and we're just refining the language. So by the time they get something back, they'll have.
I may just stick it in the file, and since it's a draft.
Yeah. Lori has been, she's not been there in person, but she's been participating on the phone, so.
And the pertinence to this discussion is really that belief is that that lack of reimbursement to certain types of providers has limited access in particular communities. So I think trying to understand the bigger picture is helpful for us as we make sure that the legislation is actually producing the effect that we desire.
That's correct.
So, Cliff, did you have any? Yeah, that was quite a series of suggestions from both of you. So, any other comments?
Nothing from me, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
I would only just add that if you have specific pieces of information you would like us to collect, to be as specific as possible in telling us what you need and maybe how you need it, so that we can target that kind of data call that we do.
So some of the things that we had talked about, and this is what we need input for, is the specific ask. So if we are in fact going to create a surveillance mechanism for this payment system change, what does that look like? What are the things that we need to create on an ongoing basis? I think is really what Cliff's saying, is that we can ask for that, and that they would be able to report that back on a periodic basis to this group to understand, did in fact the increase in reimbursement to these providers truly improve access? Did it truly improve recruitment or additional providers in the community? What was the effect of that? And so I think that's really what we wanted to open that discussion up. What would we want to include in the surveillance? What are the things that we would want to track over time?
Well, that's what I'm hearing from carriers. You know, of course, they'd like to see this bill, this go away. They don't want to extend the sunset, et cetera. But they say, well, we need more data. But I'm not quite sure what that data is, just that very question that you're asking us.
I bet we could come up with some parameters that would show you what we thought might be helpful, both from, and I think that there are a number of HEDIS measures that relate to mental health that might lend themselves to this. These would be things like follow-up after a mental health hospitalization. You might even look at things like the rates of hospitalization. Did we get any outcomes?
The hard part, Bob, though, is can you attribute it just entirely to the reimbursement changes or to everything else that's going on in
correct.
Oregon?
At no, the I think that's true.
So
but,
that's the hard
but,
part.
But, the issue at the Sunset, I think we're going to get probably to in the second half of the meeting. I think that the reality is that once something is implemented, it's hard to have a takeaway. But at the same time, if we found that there were adverse consequences, so let's say that we really did have an increased shortage of medical psychiatrists as a result of the bill. I don't necessarily anticipate that. If we did, we would want to know that, because that's also a necessary part of the workforce. So it might be that we have to actually think a little bit about what metrics we want to measure. I'm not prepared to give you a proposal off the cuff, nor do you want one. But I think we could do that for another meeting and get the carriers to participate in what some of those metrics could look like.
I hear you, Bob, volunteering your organization to provide some input.
I think we would be
some input.
I don't want it to be only us, because I John is not here.
It should be Canva. It should be. I mean, it should.
So I think John and I could take the lead on that, since we're on the committee, about what a series of metrics could look like that are standard measures, so that you don't have to reinvent the wheel. There may be some HEDIS measures that I think lend themselves to this, and we can see if we think that's adequate.
Well, we clearly, we do want to know the number of providers that are affected. How many providers actually have received enhanced payment as a result of this, and in those geographies, because I think there are some geographical issues. Did it in fact increase access? So, and what would be that access measure? So, is it increased number of patients served? Is it increased encounters? Is it other HEDIS measures? I think that we
some
have
of
to
those
figure
will be
out what is the cause and effect.
Because people have insurance now, so some of those metrics are going to have a lot of confounders, and that's I think your point, Janine, as well.
Mm-hmm. Plus the efforts in the communities with the coordinated care of really pushing on behavioral health integration. So it's, there's just confounding factors, all good things, hopefully, but it's not just the payment in isolation.
I think my point is.
And it sounds as though some of the data that you can pull is actually potentially survey data. So right now you survey the sort of the payer, and ask specific questions or a series of questions related to their compliance. It's possible we could also, some mechanism surveying the providers, that if you actually knew who those providers were, potentially as to what the effect was. So we haven't had a way to sort of track what the impact of this bill has been, and so these are the folks that could help construct that.
Our only problem with the providers is we don't have any authority over them. So it would be, we can get at it from the insurers, but the providers are not subject to our data call. if they're voluntary, if they're willing to, complete it voluntarily, that's one thing. But
but it may be even within the provider or within the parent.
Which plans have paid differently?
From the insurance care.
From the insurance perspective.
What was the?
Yeah. Because they regulate the insurance company.
Yeah, I didn't hear what your question was.
Couldn't they call? Say Providence. How are you paying? Right.
Yeah.
Or
numbers of people you're paying differently than you were before.
So how many people are on panel? That are now on panel, and you could. So, I think that we could come up with a series of metrics, and so I will connect with John. And talk to some folks and say, okay, and maybe show it to you, Janine, so that we anybody else who wants to look at it, but we can kind of work through that and say, what can we track going forward? You know, looking at supply, performance, you know, patient outcomes, if we can, I think it's true that we can't attribute, the only thing that would be easy to track and attribute directly to the bill is the increase in cost. That part is the easy part, you know, but if there's better value, you know, and patients are doing better, you know, and the costs are sustainable, then, you know, let's
and then in try the long that. Run, less healthcare costs.
Maybe. Yeah. So, but if the costs are sustainable and there's no adverse consequences, you know, that's kind of a win. And how much do we need to, you know, beat our head against the wall? But I think we need to look at the upsides and the potential downsides, if there are any. You know, so.
I guess I just want to add a thought, because in our caucus, when we talked about this bill, it was not necessarily, I mean, I don't believe that paying a nurse more gets you better health outcomes. I mean, really, it's about, for us, I think for those of us who supported it in my caucus, it was about stabilizing the provider, particularly in rural areas where they have, you know, solo practice, they, you know, their own, they have the same overhead. My question is does this help? Did we help keep providers in their communities who otherwise were leaving? We were hearing stories of people who said, I just can't afford to practice in pick whatever random small city in Oregon, you know, community, and I just can't be here anymore. And I would like to know, did we stabilize those people and keep healthcare in the community? I mean, that's really why I supported the bill and would continue to support it if that's the outcome that it's having.
So the access would be the outcome measure. And you know, what I would say about the outcome piece is that if this expanded access, so people had access to care that previously didn't have access to care, that would be an outcome piece. And I don't think it's about saying that the outcome of somebody who sees a physician or nurse practitioner is equivalent, although if it is, that would also be that's also, you know, justifies, I think, the parity piece. What we have to also get at is, are there differences in acuity? You know, we've heard that a little bit about that before. I think we may need some special programs for the most acute patients to ensure that they have maybe, you know, I think we heard some reasonable testimony from the mental health providers about maybe the need for team-based care with the most acute patients. I think those are reasonable things to do, and as a carrier, we would maybe have the flexibility to be able to implement and do something like that while we also were in spirit with the law. You know, I think that only makes good sense. So I think that there are access and outcome measures that could exactly address your concern.
The other angle would be that there has been a provider survey that the health authority has done over the years. I don't know where we are, because that's not under me at the moment. But I can find out where in the next one of those is, because you could maybe oversample these certain providers to see if and ask specific questions, possibly. Because the questions on the old one were, are you planning to leave practice? Are you planning, you know, and what are the factors of why we do it in conjunction with the medical association over the years? So maybe you could see some differences, maybe not 100% due to this bill, but possibly get you a little bit better perspective of whether they're staying.
I would like the proponents of the bill. I think what Representative Parrish is bringing up, as well as what you had said, you need to have a better clarity of definition of independent practice, because her reasoning for voting for the bill was for those, I wouldn't say just rural areas, I would say low income areas, sure. Distressed areas, I mean, in my, you know, neck of the woods, et cetera. But if the proponents of the bill could come back to us or somehow submit a definition of what they considered. Did they mean all nurse practitioners in big clinics, et cetera, or focusing on the independent practice and then helping us with a definition of independent practice?
So we'll definitely want to do that. I think that and clearly our intention is to see that access issue. Again, I think the challenge is to say, is it solely because of the action of increasing that funding, because many communities are doing lots of other things in order to try to keep their providers. It's been a very aggressive effort, and certainly in my community. So I think we need to understand, did that help? Because it may have been the straw, literally, that, you know, made that decision. And so all of those factors are important. And I think what our role is to make sure we have the workforce in place that is necessary to provide the care. And so by whatever mechanisms that is. So I think we could look at that workforce from the workforce data. That would also be helpful to track over time, you know, where are the fluctuations in workforce. And perhaps
early
then,
on, I think the first meeting I brought the modeling exercise that had looked, it didn't include, I think, I think it had in all three mm-hmm. categories in that. It set up like where we are now and what we might need. Mm-hmm. So.
Well, anecdotally, I know many nurse practitioners, and almost all of their clients are Medicaid, and there's a difference in the care that some of our low income, they have much, their environment is so much harder to sometimes keep healthy. And I know that I think is, like you say, acuity factor, because I don't want them to be getting any less money because they are really going to bat for the low-income Medicaid. So just editorial there.
Any other questions for Jeanette or Cliff? Thank you very much. It's been very helpful, and we'll look forward to some further discussions, because I think we do want to create a surveillance mechanism, and if we can help, we'll get some information from John and from Bob and others to start that discussion, to build a sort of a framework, and maybe work with you, Cliff, around what that analytic framework needs to look like, and hopefully we can get some meaningful data, and then we'll try to tie that into some of the other information and see if we can make some correlations.
Good plan. Sandy knows right. Where to find me.
Yeah, she does. She's amazing. Yeah. Yes, as I know, no matter where you are. So, again, I thank you very much for taking the time and being
thank
here
you.
With us.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, thank you. I'll send this to you.
Electronically.
Yeah.
I'll
send
it on. Yeah, if we can get that, and then we'll distribute that to the task force members.
Great.
Thank you very much.
Good. Well, hopefully that discussion, again, is helpful in that was one of the things that the group brought up, is how do we know what the impact of the bill has been. So hopefully we'll know and follow that and track that over time.
Robin or Senator Knope, did you guys have any questions to DCBS before they squeak out the door?
No, that was really, really interesting, though. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
No, I'm good.
Okay, very good. So the next item on the agenda is to go after and start walking through the next draft and revision of the report to the legislature. And as most of you, if you've had, hopefully you've had an opportunity to walk through this, there are some significant changes from the last draft. So, and those changes were based on input. One of the wonderful things about putting something out on paper is that it really does gender a reaction, which was its intention. Hopefully, as we get more and more sort of reaction and thought, by the time we submit the report, it'll truly reflect what we hope we and want the legislature to do. So we've made revisions based on input from a large number of the committee members, as well as we've had input from the Oregon psychiatric providers, as well as the physician assistant providers. We've had input from the nurses, as well as osteopathic input. We've had input as well from the OMA and their constituents. So it's been very healthy in that we've had a lot of interest and input. So hopefully, as we've gone through, Mary, who wasn't able to join us today, and Sandy and I met to collate all of the input and try to reconfigure it. And again, this is a draft, and so we tried to reflect those things, but we will want to make sure if there are additional items that will bring that out. What we'd like to do from a sort of a work order standpoint is that today we're going to focus sort of on the first section, I'll call it, which is really the sections related to our findings related to the parity piece, which is part of the reason that we had the folks from the division come to kind of give, because I think we brought up several of the issues in that discussion. And then in the subsequent meetings next month, we're going to look at sort of begin to walk through the workforce issues. And so to do that, we will ask our colleagues at the Oregon Health Policy Board and their work subcommittees to come and bring us additional information, which we haven't been able to get to that level of detail. So if that's okay with the group, that's how we plan to do today. And so we'll the time remaining, we'll focus really on the first section of the report. So again, as we went through it, we tried to reflect the comments, and so we'll open it for discussion. There are the first portion of the report really is comments. They were sort of what the testimony brought out, and tried to get some clarity around some of the things that actually probably in the first draft were not correct, and so we wanted to make sure that we had those things included. And then at the end of on page three at the bottom are the series of recommendations that we would then put forward. And so maybe what we could do, if we could talk about the sort of the body first to make sure that if there are additions, changes, or things you want to bring at this time, please do so. We will not vote on this sort of set of recommendations until next meeting. So we will have some opportunity to have further revisions if necessary in the interim, but we'd like to bring up a chance to make suggestions or edits or changes at this point. So I'll open it to the committee. Hopefully, Senator Knope and Robin, hopefully you have electronic copies of the report. So I'd like to open it up for discussion on the first section, and then we'll go into the specific recommendations. Comment or edits, changes?
Yes. So I know that there was an edit made on page three in the setting that comes after the testimony. Also pointed out the limitations of the coding systems. It's the third bullet, and it was the concern about the use of templates, which can impact the detail in the visits documentation. And the thing that was taken out had to do with the accuracy. I actually had some. This is kind of so homogenized that it actually doesn't state what the concern is. The concern is the cut and paste that implies that services were provided that really weren't provided at the time of the visit. And so that's the concern, is that, you know, cut and paste leads to the potential for, for upcoding, whether it's intentional or unintentional. You know, the word fraud was used in, it implied fraud, which isn't really true because it's not always intentional. People are kind of running on boilerplate. Mm-hmm. But I think that the new electronic medical systems often utilize templates for documentation, which may impact the accuracy of a visit's documentation. And I think that's a fair statement.
Which may impact the accuracy?
Yeah. Of a visit's documentation.
Yeah, and I believe that is the intention, Bob.
I realize, you're not accusing anybody of fraud here. I recognize the complexities and difficulties of
we didn't, and yeah, we didn't want to imply that, that was intentional at all. So I think your wording is actually is helpful. And Corey had brought up earlier in some earlier discussion that the first bullet point under that same section on testimony, the level of service does not reflect the level of training, content knowledge, quality outcomes, cumulative experience of a provider. And again, the intention wasn't that the group would recommend that, in fact, a level of service should include that. It was just noting that, in fact, that today, those factors are not necessarily included in the actual calculation of the level of service. So it's based, to Bob's point, on the document level of documentation. And so what we just wanted to do is to note that, and because that had been part of the testimony, it certainly would be an extreme challenge to add all of those elements into a specific fee-for-service level of service charge. The complexity of doing that would be very, very difficult. But it was just acknowledging that. Any other comment? And I just want to make sure that this reflects. And again, we just sent these out earlier in the week, so you may, as you go back through, and certainly our partner organizations, hopefully have an opportunity to go through this in deeper detail. And any input related to those points, want to make sure we receive so we accurately reflect the situation. So if there are any other comments on that body?
There is on the next set of bullets, the third one down about the relationship of physician assistants practicing under the license of a physician. We feel it that it's an outdated language, and we'd like to recommend that we change that language to a more modern, current statement. And one of the ways we want to say this is physician assistants carry their own license to practice and work collaboratively with our supervising physicians. We are allowed to bill insurance services via our NPI numbers. Outdated language should be modernized at this time to avoid misconceptions. That's our stance on that particular bullet point.
Okay. So let me ask a question. I hadn't really thought about this before on this. Are there legislative or regulatory mandates of the number of PAs a particular physician can supervise?
Yes.
And what is that number?
In the rural area, I believe it's 5. I believe in the urban area, it's 4.
And so that sounds actually pretty manageable to me. I was thinking, do we need to track what's actually happening along those lines? But if that's clear in the regulations, that actually sounds like it's pretty manageable.
That, yeah, that was recently updated,
yes,
right?
It
used
was.
To be like
I
1 to 1
say
or 1 to 2.
A little less than a year ago, they had a vote on that in the OMB.
It's the Zoom calendar.
Yeah, so it increased it to 4.
Yeah.
You know, is there any regulation? What's the regulation about the level of supervision that's required to meet that standard?
Supervision is very broad. You will find in a lot of the rural areas, physicians will practice alone, and the only kind of supervision they may have is a telecommunication type of a supervision. The biggest issue is that PAs need 10% per month of their charts reviewed. And those charts have to be chosen by the physician and not the physician assistant. So it's a very, very small amount of supervision.
Mm-hmm.
Would that be helpful, Bob, to clarify that in the...
Yeah, and I'm just thinking a little bit about understanding what the level of supervision that's occurring and ensuring that it's adequate. If we expand the scope and practice, you know, if this legislation and the payment parity piece doesn't affect PAs right now, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
I think it does, doesn't it? Yeah.
It does.
Yeah.
Okay. So I think that and especially as we get down to this independent practice piece where people are employed instead of independent,
mm-hmm.
that actually in my mind should allow for a higher level of supervision, because what this bill shouldn't be doing is just increasing fees to the profitability of somebody else. You know, your point earlier was to help the independent practice. You know, in larger entities that have, you know, 30 clinics and now have less supervision, and with that increased reimbursement, are not actually doing as much as may be beneficial for ensuring that the quality of the care is there, and that when patients have more acute issues, that they are handled appropriately. I think that you'd probably be comfortable with some of that.
Some of it. I mean, I am not a rural practitioner. I do have a master's in rural practice, but we do have at least I'm sure we have more than one, but I know one in particular that this bill was very, very important to, and I know there were others too, but I know one in particular who is in the rural area, and he does practice, you know, alone, and he's quite capable of handling just about anything that's given to him. Yeah.
But I think to your point, I mean, if you had a large clinic and some PAs and some nurse practitioners, and the clinic is gathering in more income as a result of this, that doesn't necessarily increase the number of nurse practitioners or raise their salaries. It just raises income to clinics.
Right. That's my point.
So, we become more profitable.
And that gets and down it, to what's that definition of an independent
I'm not sure
practice?
That's what we wanted to do.
And now we've decreased the we've decreased the level of supervision that's required, which I think has some reasons to make some sense. I'm not denying that it does. You know, I do believe that there is a benefit to having some level of oversight, and that is more than just cursory.
So getting practical about this, what we may want to do is just include some language that reflects that requirement of supervision, how that's monitored, just to it as an assurance to making sure that there's adequate support for those practices. So we'll just have to maybe clarify that. And maybe, Corey, if you could help us with some of that language around what that looks like, and also to make sure that our language is up to date.
I would love to.
That would be fabulous if you could bring us that input.
Isn't that a medical board? They're the ones that implement it.
Right.
We shouldn't be. I'd like to have input from the.
I can clarify with the PA.
We don't want to get
we'll
into
just get
this,
their language.
This, yeah. I don't want to get into the. This can get very controversial, mm-hmm. especially if we take it to the medical board. But.
So the point here, though, was really that we got testimony that helped clarify and help us understand what PAs do and their relationship, right? So I guess the question is. This is sort of like what we heard, right? And I don't know if it's a appendix that has a page that summarizes what the requirements of a PA are versus an NP versus an MD or a reference
can,
to a link out to a good page that has
language.
That. Or, I mean, the bullet here was really
very clear.
I guess I should clarify one thing about supervision, too. 10% is the requirement, but I'll tell you, most of our physicians do anywhere from 40 to 50%, at least in my practice, they do. My supervising physician actually reviews all of my charts. That's her choice. She doesn't have to, but she feels that's the way she can say that she's really supervising. So I have, you know, I have a physician that will review every chart I do. Do I get any comments back as changes? Rarely, very rarely. You know, that's just the nature of the beast. You know, the number of years you practice, the more ability you have, and when you have a veteran PA, you really can't say that their practice is less than most practitioners. So,
I think that the issue of experience is very relevant.
Yes, and, very much so.
But as we have expansion in the workforce, mm-hmm. and the requirements went lower, and we've now increased the resources to potentially some of those large entities with lots of employed PAs, mm-hmm. you know, are we? Do we have any sense of whether there's some adverse consequence mm-hmm. of that? And you know, I think that would be hard to measure. Mm-hmm. You know, I've been envisioning some things. I agree, Senator Mona Sanderson. That's up to that's my intellectual curiosity as a carer and ensuring the care of our members. And I don't know that I want any regulations or mandates about that or require things in the reporting. I think I think that if I have that much intellectual curiosity, I can report it on my own and share it with whomever I please. You know.
Well, I know that some practices actually start off with a much higher percentage of a review, and as you go along, they drop that percentage. So I know in the OMB they had discussed that at one time, too, how if a PA is new to the practice or a new PA, they will increase the number of charts they review by percentage, and then they drop it over the period of time. So even the OMB has been talking about this as well.
Well, I can actually tell you that at the health plan, the pharmacy department's analysts, and they've coined a term for what I just did, which was called a Bob Blob. So
A Bob Blob?
So I realized that we don't want any of those in the regulations.
I think I'll remember that. I know some other Bobs I could use.
Bob Dannenhofer's in your neck of the woods.
Well, we'll get that additional language and then include that as in our appendix. So we'll make sure that, because there'll be several things that we'll actually bring into that as well. Okay, if it's okay with the group, any comments, Senator Knope or Robin, do you have any comments that you want to make at this point before we go to the actual recommendations?
Just one. Are we going, looks like the report is silent as it relates to the issue that I think we discussed maybe in the previous meeting regarding social workers and some of the other providers and their pay. Does it make sense to make a note in the report that those are also issues?
Thank you, Senator. This is Sandy. I was thinking of making kind of a section after the recommendations and maybe before, like, the conclusion of additional information that we received, you know, testimony and comments on, and I was going to incorporate it in that. So you'll see something along those lines in the next version of this.
Just as I share that same concern that the senator has, just simply because in practice, the bulk of that type of service of behavioral health being provided in primary care is not being provided by, you know, just the nurse practitioners and the physician assistants. The actual bulk of those services, especially within the CCOs, are being provided by other types of providers that were not addressed at all in this legislation or report.
One thing that I think it's fair to say, though, is that the services that are provided are not equivalent because there isn't prescribing privileges. And whereas, you know, the nurse practitioners theoretically on a particular patient could provide a more comprehensive level of care. So I think there may be some fairness about, you know, what is the level of difference. But I don't know that you could say that it's parity because the services that are able to be provided do not have parity to them.
Well, let's be really, really, really clear. Prescribing is not the same as the level of services that are provided by trained behavioral health consultants.
I understand.
It's not about the prescription. It's about the therapy. So when you're talking about comprehensive, you're starting to get into the philosophical issues of what is appropriate care. And quite frankly, a pill is not always the solution.
No, I agree. I agree with that.
But, and I would add, as you know, as we looked at the workforce question, clearly providers outside of the three categories that we're looking at are an important part of our workforce, particularly in the mental health side, but even in the primary care side with the primary care medical home. So, again, I think those are things that were brought up. Those are things I think that we need to raise to the attention, certainly of the legislature, to make sure that there is adequate workforce compensation, et cetera, for that group. That's not within the scope of the specific work that we were tasked with, but I think we do need to note that. So either we'll do that in the body of that workforce discussion or we'll add that into the second part, because there's clearly a need to make sure that that portion of the workforce is also supported.
Well, and I think part of where this gets confusing for folks is when you look at the title of this work group and look at the practice of what happens in primary care, we need to be very clear that the totality of effort around the provision of behavioral health services, it's not that this work is more comprehensive by any stretch. This is just a very narrow scope of that work, and we run the risk of making a statement that, oh, well, now we've solved the problem of integration of behavioral health. We haven't. That was never the point of this task force. That's so right. I think we need to be really clear in how we explain that.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah. Yeah, well said. Okay. Thank you very much. Good comments. Okay, the last portion and the remainder of the meeting, I just want to make sure that we have significantly changed the recommendations from the prior draft, and so I wanted to open it up for discussion. The input that we received really led us to do that. The first bullet point or first recommendation is to maintain the sunset language and the task force continue to evaluate the things that follow.
Now, I have a question on that. Does that mean that the sunset will be removed at some point? I can interpret this two different ways.
And we can certainly clarify the intent of the language, and it's an important point, was that we maintain the sunset language today as we look at this.
But that will be 2016, correct?
Well,
it, 2018.
2018 is when it, okay. When actually what would happen is if we did nothing, then in 2018 it would go back to the ability of an insurer to have differential payment. So if we do nothing, that provision will sunset and it will go revert back to what it was before. So part of the testimony and the things that feedback that we got was that our work wasn't done and that we really needed to understand A, the impact of this legislation to our earlier point, and whether or not maintaining this language and not removing the sunset at this point also continues to press the legislature and us to make sure that we address the more the bigger task of looking at payment reform.
I have a little issue with that because we can keep saying we want more data, we want more data, we want more data, and then we don't really get the data, and then the sunset comes, and then it goes back to differential, because I'm hoping that we get away from the differential. And so I just need to put that on the record.
I have a couple of questions, because I just don't know if, you know, that's how the legislative process works, because if the legislator could choose to just extend the sunset by passing a bill again. So that's one issue. The second issue, the one thing that I do have some concern about is that the more we embed things in the fee-for-service world, the harder it's going to be to get payment reform, which is another thing that we'd like to do. So interestingly, after we had our telehealth task force meeting yesterday, I had an email exchange with someone that we're working with on that is looking to develop a telehealth platform, and you know we cover this in some products now. We're going to cover it in, I think, more or all in 15, and they are really wedded to having a different fee for different levels of service that are provided, which is far more difficult for us to implement and also to monitor, and so the more we have these types of requirements in the fee-for-service system, I think it's going to be harder to get people to move to a more capitated or, you know, global payment system.
I would agree that I think as a system are moving toward a global, I always call it global budget,
yeah.
But because we need to get away from fee-for-service, but we're in this transition period, and until we can get to that real true payment form, and I don't think this bill would hurt if we remove the sunset, this bill would hurt payment reform, because I think we're down, the train has left the track, we're going that route, it's just going to take an incredibly long time.
It's just hard to get providers to want to move from what they know to something that provides them with less certainty. You know, you know, the idea behind payment reform is to really drive the transformation of care. And but if the provider's minds, it always means that there has to be more, that it isn't going to be the same or less. And less means, you know, has to do with if there's any type of quality or utilization, you know, total cost of care requirement, then that there's some shared risk. So I think a takeaway, like I said earlier, is really hard. And I don't know if there's a provision that can be put in that actually requires the legislator to, as part of the sunset, for them to revisit it, so that they actually have to revisit it. You know, I mean, that's really what I think the intent is.
It's revisiting and revisiting and revisiting. Yeah.
But I think takeaways are pretty hard. They'd have to be a compelling reason that.
See, the CCO model is going to that, and I think they're going to be a model. And once we have a lot of data from the CCO model and the global budget that we have with them, and how we see the costs, and I don't know if they'll have data to compare the payments with, you know, how they do payments to.
But in the provider mind, they're, you know, the
actually
the threat-
I can address that just because I happen to be in one of those CCOs that has, I think we're probably the only one that did a full global budget where the hospital and the providers all went at risk. And what we do on a quarterly basis is track by claims what would have been paid, what we would have made, versus what we got as part of the global budget. And it's a scary thing. I think you will have some data on that in the next year, and golly, it's so fun to be out there on the cutting, bleeding edge of healthcare reform. However, I think the idea that this legislation is going to impact global budget, I think is in some ways naive, simply because we've never had that conversation internally. It's like a level of detail that when you're going after the global budget, you have to start thinking and looking differently. And is it scary? Yep, absolutely. But I don't know that this, I see it as two very, very, very different things.
I guess just the very fact that you guys are translating that back into what you would have made, until we get out of the mindset that we stop changing in our head a capitation rate to really what that means to me, RBRVS, on a fee-for-service basis, which, quite frankly, is what everybody is still doing in their head and often in practice, you know, when it gets down to somebody's actual salary, until we take that language away and stop talking about it, it won't go away. And so as long as it's out there, everybody will keep making that translation in their head. And as long as they keep making that translation, their mindset doesn't really change.
And the other factor, though, is that in Medicaid, people, you know, their livelihood, there varies, because there are some practices that focus on Medicaid only. In the commercial world, where this is kind of coming into play, they feel the threat much more about change, where because the dollars are so much greater. And so it's, I think we're on the way, but I think that it's harder than. Then it's hard. It's really hard.
From a purely practical perspective, does this mean that the task force continues until 20 something, or is do we
have
set
to start paying?
Date
that's what this means.
Where
yes.
The task force is reconvened to reassess, or I mean, what's our game plan here? I think because that's what these recommendations made me think about.
Yeah, currently the task force would sunset in 2016. In order for us to probably really effectively deal with these things and truly learn from the lessons of the CCO, I mean, it's, again, we don't have the data to say that that model has really truly changed things because we haven't been in place long enough. The sense was is that this group needs to continue to meet and shepherd over time, and that, in fact, that's our original date of sunset of the task force may end up needing to be extended. So we don't know yet. So now it could be that we'll have all the answers and we'll make our final report prior to that 2016 date, and that will be it, or that we may see the necessity of this group continue to meet beyond that point, at which point we'll need to obviously address that sunset.
2016 date is in order to prepare to be ready for the legislators to do something
right.
Before it sunsets.
Well, that poses a very interesting question then. Can a recommendation of the task force be to extend their scope into some of the areas that we've identified that also need to be discussed that currently are not within our scope?
Well, that would be up to the legislators at this point. I was just focused on the problems that arose when one of the carriers all of a sudden started paying nurse practitioners a different rate. And so that was the intent of the bill, to at least for some, like those PAs working independently or nurse practitioners working independently. That's why I would prefer to really get a definition of independent practice, see if the carriers are okay with that, and remove the sunset. But this is a committee, and you know I will respect what you will recommend. But I was hoping that we could at least temporarily not have to readdress this, because it's going to be a while before we have all the data that we need. A long time.
And I think, but Robin brings up a good point, is, you know, who actually is going to look at practitioners that are outside of the scope of this work? I don't know if this is the right configuration of people around the table to really to understand the complexities of the behavioral health system or others and how those particular practitioners are utilized. That would be something we'd have to consider, whether it's a separate task force that ends up looking at that that issue. I think that is always an option. But as we put the recommendations together, we did not make that specific recommendation that we expand our scope, again, because given our current charge and our current configuration, you know, internally we felt perhaps that was maybe not in our best interest. So
I don't know that it, I'll just pop in, I don't know that it's necessarily the that we're the right group, given that we were tasked to do 2902, but I think it's important to put something into this report that addresses that, so that, you know, chairs of the committees see that we've identified it as a problem. They can put forward another piece of legislation that tasks that to somebody else or decides to add that to our scope, but I think leaving it out is a mistake, because I think they need to know. I think they at least need to say we've identified that in multiple meetings, that the behavioral side and other practitioners is a, you know, is a concern. I think we'd be remiss in not making sure that there is at least some reference to that, and then let the healthcare committees make that determination if they change the scope of this for future work or create a different work group based on that recommendation.
So. Well said. We'll try to look at potential recommendation language that would, again, just sort of put it back in the laps of our legislative assembly to try to just figure out how they want to approach that.
A little present for Mitch.
Since, yeah.
We're going to punt it right
back to you.
Parameters that it's related to behavioral health and primary care integration, right? Because mm-hmm. you could get acupuncture from that.
Again, that's beyond our scope. So, again, that was the reason for item one and maintaining that language, again, as we felt that our work wasn't done. At this point, I don't think we absolutely have to ask them to extend the life of this task force. That may be a recommendation that we would bring in the future. We don't have to put that in. We could. And then I think item number two, I think we've had a discussion today that that is very important, is really having the clarity around the definition of independent practice and how those billing practices actually function. So, and clearly that was a directive of the division.
I did confirm that for PEB employees that the NP parity provisions are implemented for behavioral health, and I knew they were already for physical, so not an issue.
Good.
That's always good news.
Senator Monis Anderson's question. In terms of the change in the recommendation about removing the sunset language, so I read over the feedback, and the feedback seemed to be, if you looked at the amount of feedback, yes, there was a lot of feedback saying don't remove the sunset, but when you looked at the feedback by discipline, it seemed to fall along some fairly traditional lines. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if that's a conversation that we should have as a consideration in how we approach this.
Very good. Yeah, it'd be nice it really isn't a consensus, but majority rules in most cases, so I think in the report it would be nice to know who would be against maintaining the sunset and who would be against by discipline, who you represent.
Well, we can add all the comments as appendices, so that will be part of
For this committee. Mm-hmm. From this committee.
You mean the committee members?
The task force?
Yeah, the task force.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
We can certainly do that. I think from the medical association standpoint, they felt that they need to maintain the, because they felt that the work wasn't done. And that there really, what if we take away that sunset language, that perhaps the issue would then fall under the back burner around true payment reform. And so their sense was is that as long as it's there, we're going to continue to bring back and address some of these other issues. And that was the feeling.
So the medical association sees this bill as a driver for payment reform?
They don't feel it is the key driver for payment reform, but it clearly has kept that discussion going from yet another angle.
I think that there is some question in my mind as to whether it's a potential impediment to payment reform rather than a driver. The more we become attached to changes to raise the payments on fee-for-service, the less incentive there is to look for alternatives. And I think we face some of that with other areas that I also support, by the way. As I mentioned, we have a longer history prior to this bill on the physical health side. The bill did make a change in behavior on the part of Providence on the mental health side. I think that the only reason to have the sunset in my mind is to ensure that there aren't any adverse consequences to the legislation, so not to take away something that would be working.
Yeah, and I would agree. I think the sunset language kind of forces us to reevaluate and test it and see if it actually worked and does it need to be tweaked. Rather than just let it stay. Otherwise, we probably won't do that.
And Ruth, you represent which one?
Atrio.
Yeah.
I think on this task force, I'm also an insurer representative.
Right.
Not a physician representative.
You're not really.
As is John.
I
you play one on television.
I am the doctor.
And we most of the comments and testimony we sent out to the group. So hopefully everybody's had a chance to read those letters and the testimony that's come in.
I did not send all the individual electronic letters. If you guys want it, I'll try and scan it into one document, and then you can read them all.
Yeah, you sent the summary, though.
I did send the summary, and this was a paraphrase from what they highlighted. So. I mean, it's not like...
If you want the specific, we can certainly...
Yeah, just let me know if you want to see all the individual comments that were submitted. And
very robust. I mean, the wonderful part about it to me was that people were interested and actually truly interested in the end game. So where are we? How are we going to get out of the fee-for-service system and into a different type of reimbursement system that actually supports the model of care? And I think that was very positive. And that was from everyone. All of the input that we received. So, Robin, did you want to make a specific comment related to that? Or did we lose you?
Robin?
No, you lose me. I'm just thinking. I'm not quite formulated.
We don't have you on Skype, so we couldn't look at that sort of inquisitive, puzzling face. So we weren't sure where you were at in that thought process.
Thanks.
Yeah, we certainly could bring back additional discussion in the future. I think that input is relative to to the size of the organizations and the folks, the number of people that are affected. So we did hear a good input, and we got input from providers that are not necessarily in the scope that they indeed also had issues. And so to that point, we'll make sure we include those recommendations as well. So item 3 on was to assure the compliance, and again that's surveillance mechanism, and that is indeed the group that does that. So again, we wanted to make sure that was an ongoing process, and really to Bob's point, have we achieved the results that we wanted to, and were there any adverse results related to that? So hopefully we'll have a better understanding over the next year or so as we monitor those things to be able to have confidence in removing the sunset that in fact it did indeed do what we had intended.
I guess I would have a question at this point. I have yet to hear a whole lot about adverse impact, and in the absence of adverse impact, And did I miss the meeting or miss some time when we had some conversation about adverse impact?
Yeah, I think that the only thing I heard about adverse impact is, could there become a shortage of medical psychiatrists in the community because of the because there was a perception that there wasn't a recognition of the increased training. I'm not claiming that I necessarily agree with that. You know, I think that what's really most relevant, my own personal opinion, is that what's most relevant is how is their compensation compared to other communities, you know, other geographic regions. But I think that sometimes it's about perception, and could that perception lead to the lack of ability to attract medical psychiatrists? I guess I don't know that with certainty. I'm not aware of any, you know, the only other adverse impact there could be is what happens to the total cost of care when we have state mandates that, for example, for state employees, that they're really trying to limit the cost of care to 3.4%. And, that's also part of the recommendations, is to try to have a cap on global expenditures to at least have, my belief is that this is not a budget buster, you know, that this alone, I think we have other things that have greater significance and consequence. But I think the idea of having the transparency, saying that we will study it, did we get any benefit or did it just increase cost, is reasonable. And I'll come back to something I said like three times. I think takeaways are really hard. There has to be a reason for a takeaway to occur. And I would think that there's a low likelihood that that would happen if I had to bet. You know, and I recognize, because you want to have some sustainability. I do think one thing that I hadn't really thought as much about before the meeting today is what's the impact on independent practice versus, and what was the intent there? And that is something that I think that is worthy of some revisitation.
That's really, really helpful. Thank you. Because I thought it was just, I just find it all quite so odd at a time when we have such an incredible shortage of, whether you're talking psychiatry, nurse practitioners who specialize in psych, or PAs who specialize in psych. Anywhere you go in this state, we have a shortage, an incredible shortage. And anything that we can do to incentivize people to engage in and practice in the area of behavioral health is something that we should do. So having a conversation about stopping the removal of a sunset that might incentivize other providers to get in here at a time when we're on a burning platform, and I don't see a whole rush of mental health providers coming anywhere towards us soon, is just a little bit surprising, and it's hard to rationalize in my mind as I'm sitting here trying to coerce people to come and practice in my community.
And
I agree with you. It's budget dust.
Yeah, and the other thing
I'm stunned.
The other thing I kind of have become interested in, I think other payers might, is I think that this kind of creates the requirement for payers to come up with more novel models on how to take care of the most complex patients that would really benefit from a team that includes a physician in addition to a nurse practitioner, because the patients are really complicated and those patients are worthy of having more resources attributed to them. And so I think that could be a potential multi-payer collaborative in that area. I think it would address some of the concerns that were raised in earlier testimony by the psychiatrists, and so I think there's some opportunity there to lay those legitimate concerns that may be there, that to the betterment of patient care, and also meet the legitimate concerns of nurse practitioners. I think that there's a way forward that we can actually make this an attractive place for mental health providers from multiple disciplines.
I mean, you know, Robin, I understand your issue about in terms of attracting folks into the professions, whether it be primary care for physical health or behavioral health. But I think it's prudent at any time we do something to find a way to measure it and make sure that it achieves the goal that we want it to achieve. Seems like it would, but I think we have to find out if that really happens. Now, frankly, I mean, I think 2016 is probably a pretty short horizon. maybe we ought to think about whether that should be extended out enough time that it actually, we think that this could have an impact. What is that horizon? You know, how long would it take for this to attract more people and get better access? Can that happen in a little less than a year?
It was 18 before, so it'd be 3 years.
I thought we said it was going to sunset.
So the task force itself, the actual sunset is in 18.
18. Then that should give enough time for people to get in and see if it really does. I mean, if all it does is it pays the same number of people this, you know, same more money, and we don't have any more access, and we still have clinics that are failing in rural areas, then it'll tell us we didn't really achieve what we wanted to.
I was thinking that this last bullet of four, to, especially because of what Ruth just said and Representative Parrish, we need to include access, because it's access, clinical impact, and financial impact.
Mm-hmm. What was your verbiage? Access?
Somewhere the word access needs to go in there. So report impacts due to, I mean clinical impacts, financial impacts, access impacts.
Okay.
Was it access under clinical? Maybe they could spell that out more.
Yeah, I don't think people see access in there.
Sure.
I was thinking more quality of care. Yeah.
Additional comment? Senator Knope, do you have any additional comments on the recommendations or things that you need us to make sure we put in there?
I do not.
I do want to go back to number two for just a second when we're asking the legislature to kind of clarify independent practice. Is it our expectation that we make that recommendation and they come up with that, or is it our thought that we're going to provide them guidance on that?
Well, we asked earlier if the proponents of the bill could come up with a definition. Isn't that correct?
I mean, I hadn't thought about this part of it before. That's what was that just the art of wording it, or was that the intent, or what, or do we know?
I think carriers and the proponents can come with what they how they would like to see.
But then
it,
do we put that in as a definition? The question is, so do we then determine that and put that forward?
Is this about the independent practice?
And we can talk about who actually does that. But I think it was clear that there was confusion, and that the definition that was actually outlined was not adequate, or was just not clear enough, down to the level of the people actually doing the work, which not necessarily surprising.
But the purpose of clarifying was to help the monitoring of it, correct? Because that sounds like. The plans have interpreted it.
I think there's been some differences. For what it sounds like, if there was a complaint and it revolved around the independent practice, we know there is a carrier that maybe interpreted it, and I could conceive how that could be interpreted as nurse practitioners who practice have a different tax ID number. There are no physicians in the tax ID number. That's not how we've chosen to implement this, but I could see how that could be construed. And so I think this is a little on the murky side.
Yeah, and in the if we're the body that's going to help clarify that, I think that we can certainly task ourselves with that. Let the legislative committee know that we will review and assist the division in that clarification. But it would be helpful, the folks that actually wrote it. It would be helpful to understand why they wrote the way they did, and are there ways that we could improve that language to just get clarity? Because if it's left to interpretation, there's all sorts of creativity that goes into play.
Just from a process perspective, in the 4 years I've been, almost 4 years I've been doing this now, certainly Lori's been doing a lot longer. Sometimes you make a recommendation, and somebody else goes off and makes that determination absent of the input of the people who made the recommendation, and you get something entirely different, and then suddenly you've got a new set of problems. So I just want to make sure that if we are going to ask them to clarify, that we make sure that there's some kind of addition to this final document that says, and this is what people think that actually means, so that we're giving them that specific guidance, because otherwise there is a very great possibility that they come back with something entirely different.
Well, the carriers and the advocates need to come together on this, And I know the carriers may have one definition and the advocates may have a different definition, yeah. And somehow,
yep.
Yeah, they get together on that. Okay.
Definitely have to have an understanding of what that actually looks like. So I think we can work on that, and so Sandy, we'll try to make sure that language reflects that. And then the Senator's earlier point around, you know, does that require legislative action? It seemed like most of that could be done internally with rules. So, but if there is actually legislative things that need to occur, then I suppose we would have to bring that
and
back.
And the definition is the one thing that I heard we need.
Yeah,
to
we
have
need legislation for the definition.
Okay. It seemed like.
Well, we're still on the timeline,
yep.
So we
uh-huh.
can't.
Okay, we're almost ready to wrap up. Any additional comments, suggestions? Obviously, we're going to have a little additional work to do with those recommendations, and we'll bring that back for further discussion and potential vote at our next meeting. Any additional comment? Those on the phone? Okay, hearing none, we will go ahead and kind of finish this discussion. As far as our next meeting is scheduled for the 19th of September, so hopefully everybody has that on the schedules. It will be the same time, I'm not sure, same location, but it will be most likely in this building.
So, you know, I'm out of town, I'll have to vote by proxy.
Alrighty. So doing something fun, I hope.
I'm in a meeting.
Oh, meeting. And we'll have you dial.
I'll be out of town, and I will be doing something fun. So,
okay, so you'll be gone.
At least somebody will have it.
So this is the 19th, and we're still at the same time, correct?
Yeah, 8, and that's at the. Right. Yeah, that's the week of Ledge Days. Okay. We have Ledge Days Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday.
And so as far as location, and we understand folks' schedule, that will be always an issue. So.
And you won't be calling in, correct, Ruth?
I will not be calling.
I will not.
And you will not. Okay.
And I have a. I have another commitment at noon in Portland.
Okay. Well, we do 8 to 10, and then, but maybe you'll want to be in.
Maybe
just let me know
phone.
If you
yeah,
if you guys want to call in or whatever.
Okay, if there's no other further business, we're adjourned. Further business, we're adjourned.